Our meeting will come to order, please. This is the 27th day of February. We do not have a quorum yet, I don't think. Quorum is present, so we are officially called to order. Representative Ward, would you look over the minutes and consider approving them? Everyone, it's always a good idea to look over the minutes, especially the motions, to make sure that they're accurate.
Madam Chair, minutes are extensive because we had a long, long meeting. I believe they're accurate, and I'd move that they be approved.
Representative Ward moves approval of minutes. Is there any discussion? Hearing none and seeing none, all those in favor of the minutes say yes.
Yes.
Yes. Those who disagree, no. The motion prevails, and the minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Ward. Well, today, everyone, we're going to hear tax credit bills, and we are going to lead off with Representative Sarah Anderson. These are all going to be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. So, Representative Roz Peterson, would you move House File 7-2 to be before the committee and re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance?
So moved.
Representative Roz Peterson moves House File 7-2 to be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. Welcome to our committee, Representative Anderson, and begin your presentation after you introduce yourself to explain House File 7-2.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will be brief. I'm State Representative Sarah Anderson. I have the bill before you today. It is a bill that I've worked on a couple different years, and what it does is it extends our existing education expense credit to pre-K expenses. So what you're seeing, the great thing about parents these days is they're doing more and more to prepare their children for kindergarten, and this will give them a leg up in trying to get them even more prepared so that they're ready to go when they enter kindergarten. And that's the bulk of my bill, Madam Chair, and if you have any questions, I'm here.
Questions from members. Representative Anderson, how do you see this playing into much of the movement this session for universal pre-K? Is there any connection that you see between the use of this and those programs that might go forward?
So, Madam Chair,
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. If you look, the Department of Revenue has some great resources that explain what the existing K-12 credit can be used for. Things like textbooks, computers, things of that nature, tools that help a child learn and get prepared. And so this is just another tool in the tool chest for parents to use to help their children get a leg up when it comes to education. And that's the bulk of it. As far as kind of the rest of the policy side of it, I was working on this bill before that was even a mention. So this is kind of just a personal thing for me.
So Representative Anderson, the use of iPads, for example, would that be considered and other technology that you might think of that you could share with us?
Yes, Madam Chair. It would include computers, even the rental or purchase of educational equipment. So, yeah, the list is lengthy, and it's just a great resource for parents to use in helping their kids.
Representative Ward has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Anderson. I'd just like to understand this a little bit better. How does it work if families are receiving credits for pre-K, as in this bill, but also receiving, could they also receive child care credits so that they might be receiving benefits on both childcare and this pre-K deduction?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Ward, that's a great question. I'll ask staff to get further information. I know on one part of the credit, it does recognize that you can't be basically double dipping. I don't know if that applies to the child care credit, though.
Ms. Manzi, would you like to come forward and make sure that we all understand that that cannot happen? Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and answer the question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Nina Manzi from the House Research Department. If, with regard to the deduction, if you look on page 1, line 17 of the bill, you see that it says the amount paid to others less the amount used to claim the credit allowed under Section 290.0674, and that's the K-12 education credit. And then the new language references the amounts used to claim the credit under Section 290.067, and that is the dependent care credit. So the deduction may not be claimed for pre-K expenses if those expenses are already being used to claim the dependent care credit. And then, let's see, with regard to the credit on page 5, lines 25 to 26, again, you see the language, to the extent not used to claim the credit under Section 290.067. So there wouldn't be sort of like double dipping for the dependent care credit and either the K-12 credit or deduction with regard to the pre-K expenses.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that clarification. Does that also then apply to, how does that work with scholarships? If they get one of the early learning scholarships, can they also get a tax deduction?
Ms. Manzi.
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, that would work the way it works under current law for the dependent care credit, where if you are receiving a scholarship that pays for a portion of the pre-K expenses and the parent or guardian is paying for the rest out of pocket, they would be able to claim the credit for the portion that they're paying out of pocket, but not the portion for which they received the scholarship. And that's the same with like basic sliding fee for the dependent care credit. The basic sliding fee pays for a portion of child care, and then the parent pays the rest, and they can claim the dependent care credit for the portion that they actually pay.
Representative Yarusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you expect there to be any overlap in families that would be not claiming the dependent care credit but taking advantage of the pre-tax dollars for dependent care?
Ms. Manzi.
Madam Chair, Representative Yarusso, there might be. It, of course, depends. You can only use the pre-tax account if your employer offers a pre-tax account. And those tend to be of greater benefit than the credit to people with higher incomes who face higher marginal tax rates. So that's something that we would have to wait to see the estimate from the Department of Revenue when the bill would get to taxes.
Are there other questions? Seeing none, are there any in the audience who would like to speak for or with concerns about House File 72? Thank you, Ms. Manzi. Seeing none, Representative Roz Peterson renews her motion that House File 72 be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails and the bill is moved to the Committee on Education Finance. Thank you, Carmen. Representative Anderson, House File 667. And Abigail Whalen, would you move that, please?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Whalen moves House File 667 to be before the committee and then be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. Welcome again, Representative Anderson. And now we're moving a little higher up in our grade levels. This is a K-12 education expense credit that you're modifying. Please explain your bill.
Sure. So, members, what I'm doing here is expanding the K-12 education expense credit. When this credit was first put in place, it was back in the Carlson years, actually, and what I'm trying to do is bring it up to inflation. So the new numbers are based on what it would be if we had put an inflationary factor in there. So that includes the $1,500 and then bringing up the level to $50,000. Again, this helps families to do the entire program of education expenses. We're expanding that reach to make sure that more families can access it. It's been a little out of date, and this is just a refresher of the credit itself and reflective of the times. So,
thank you. Are there questions from members? Is there anyone? Oh, Representative Yarusa.
Really more of a comment, but I just kind of wanted to point out that this is a 50% increase, but you said it was the Carlson years. How long, do you have a year when it was last increased or put in place?
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, I believe it was 1997.
Madam Representative Yarusa.
Thank you. And do we have an idea what the what inflation has been since then, generally?
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, the numbers here were put together by Nina Manzi with the House Research Department, and she says it reflects the inflation. It would probably have been just $49,000, but I asked her to round it up to $50,000.
Representative Yarusa.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Are there any other questions or concerns? Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to comment as well how important it is that we do recognize that inflation has an impact. Appreciate the clarification on the years and rounding up issue. That may serve us for a little while longer, right? Because there's no inflationary factor. So there is a question. There's no inflationary factor included in this, correct?
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, there is. So going forward, we recognize the inflation, and that's included as part of the bill. Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I haven't had a chance to look at it. What was that inflation factor?
So, Representative Ward, beginning in the tax year 2016, it would be annually adjusted for inflation.
Is there a number associated with that?
Representative Anderson, would you like Ms. Manzi to come forward? Or?
Well, Madam Chair, inflation is different every year, so you can't put...
I'm sorry, is it just identified as the rate of...
Representative
stated?
Ward?
Is that just stated as the rate of annual inflation based on
Representative Anderson.
Federal figures?
Yes.
Or?
Is that based on federal?
Madam Chair, if I could direct Representative Ward to page 2, subsection 2, subdivision 6, and it lays out the entire inflation amount and how it's going to be adjusted. So if you get a chance, if you can read through that, that will help you understand what the bill does.
Very good, Representative Anderson. Thank you very much. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Anderson, for this bill. I agree with the principle that we should be funding our public education at the very least at inflationary levels. This bill will be moving to finance, where I suspect we'll have a much deeper finance discussion. But since you've laid out the principle of funding education at inflationary levels, would that be your position relative to our K-12 general fund formula appropriations?
Representative Anderson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mariani, I believe that we're not supposed to question the motives of members and their positions on different issues.
Madam Chair, there's no question of motive here. It's a simple question of whether or not this principle on the part of this author is one that should be applied across the board when it comes to the important issue of funding our schools.
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, I welcome any input that you have on the issue. I know that you've talked about this issue quite a bit on the House floor. I noticed in the last 2 years you didn't change that for education funding, and be interested in what your reasons were for that.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, Mariani. We came off the floor here with a 1.5% increase for each year, which at the very least provided for an inflationary increase. This year, unfortunately, both parties, quite frankly, are not even talking about inflationary increases. So the question is not really a partisan question. It's really a question of principle here. And I think you have a very important principle here that we should be acknowledging the impact of inflation on these important appropriations. You're doing that with pre-K credits. I support this. I think this is a really good idea. The question is just simply whether or not this is going to be a consistent principle on your part. It certainly is a consistent principle on my part. I'll be working for this across the board. And so you've opened the door here for, I think, a very important discussion. I'm just simply looking for your understanding, your clarification of whether or not this is a commitment that applies across the board.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just trying to get some better feedback from you, Representative Mariani, on why you chose not to tie education funding to inflation on a permanent basis, and you only did it for a temporary basis. So if you can kind of help me understand what your thought process was in not tying education funding permanently to inflation, that would be helpful for me to know going forward, and I welcome all your input on that.
Well, Madam Chair,
Representative Mariani.
Representative Anderson, it's a great technique to not answer a question by asking another question. However, the point, I think, has been made, and we'll have this discussion in K-12 finance. Thank you for your bill, and thank you for laying out the principle here that public education should be funded at the very least, including inflationary increases on a regular basis. I appreciate your bill, Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Anderson. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify with support or concerns in regard to House File 667? So, Representative Anderson, would you like to make closing comments on both your bills? Oh, excuse me, Representative Grisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Anderson, for bringing the bill. One of the things I appreciate is when we try to solve the problem by different means, and by bringing this problem directly to families, I think it has great merit, and I think it just really talks about how many of these problems can be solved, not just at a top level, but all the way down into the family budget. So, I appreciate both your bills, and especially think this one has a lot of merit. So good luck in the next committee.
And Representative Anderson, have you done any research to see how many families might take advantage of either House File 7-2 or 667? Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, if memory serves me correctly, I think there was just shy I can find my notes on it. There was 53,500 filers that claimed the credit in the most recent tax year for which data is available, and that under that, the dollar amount claimed was only $12.9 million, which results in an average credit of $241. And the credit is at a percentage of 75%, so the average family was claiming the credit had $321 in qualifying expenses.
And any projection as to how many would use the pre-K?
No, but hopefully documents will show that when we get to the tax committee, we'll have a better idea.
Thank you very much, Representative Anderson. Any other? Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Anderson, I don't have the obligation to serve on the tax committee. And one question I always have about tax credits is how well they work for particularly low-income families, because in this committee, at least ostensibly, we're focused on the education achievement gap and focused on the inability of children who are raised in poverty to succeed in school without some outside help or a very strong family or social network, and regrettably, too many of them don't have it. I guess the question is, does a tax credit like this help low-income families, or is this more geared towards families that have some income and some income tax to offset?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a good question, Representative Winkler. I've been working with a constituent of mine who used to work for the Federal Reserve, who's very passionate about this issue, and so we've been talking about how we can make sure that we are helping those who need it and most who need assistance on preparing their children for education as much as possible. So any input that you have, I'd welcome it.
Madam Chair.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Representative Anderson, and I think that he's probably down in Arizona right now, if we're talking about the same person. But the question is, does this work for low-income families? And based on your experience with tax credits and what you know from service on the tax committee, I think you've been a long-standing member. Do credits like this serve very low-income families very well? I just don't know the answer.
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, on the data that we have most recently, 53,500 families were able to access it. Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I'm not saying that it's bad to have a tax credit that serves kind of the working poor or families who are close to the median income or just below, but does that 53,000 families represent sort of middle income, lower income? I just don't know the answer. And and if you don't know the answer, that's fine. I just am curious what it is.
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair and Representative Winkler, as the credit is currently structured, it starts to phase out. I believe it's at $33,500. So, yes, it does help low-income families.
Thanks.
Closing comments.
Just ask for your support.
Thank you. Representative Whalen then renews her motion that House File 667 be referred to the Committee on Education Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to the Committee on Education Finance. Thank you very much, Representative Anderson, for bringing these two tax credits before us. Representative Knobloch. Welcome to our committee. Representative Lucero, would you please move Representative Knobloch 798 to be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Lucero moves 798 to be before the committee and re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. Welcome to our committee, Representative Knobloch, and if you would explain after you introduce yourself this very good bill.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Representative Jim Knobloch, St. Cloud, and members, I appreciate the chance to appear before your committee. House File 798 is similar in some respects to the bill that you just heard, but perhaps a little bit more comprehensive. What it does is, like the past bill, it updates the current education deduction and the current tax credit for inflation. The tax deduction that we've had for education expenses, including private school tuition, has actually been on our books in this state since 1955, so it goes back many, many years. The tax credit was added in the Arnie Carlson years in 1997. And the tax deduction does not have any income limit on it, but what it does do, this bill, though, is it increases the size of the deduction that someone can take advantage of. Right now, it's $1,625 for children grades K through 6, it's $2,500 for 7 through 12, and it increases that by roughly 50% to take advantage or to reflect changes in inflation that have taken place since the last time it was updated. The K-12 credit, which is income-based, as was mentioned, and right now begins to phase out at an income of $33,500. That phase-out is increased to $47,500, at which case it begins to phase out. The credit is increased from $1,000 to $1,500 per child. And like the tax deduction, it would now, underneath this bill, include private school tuition. And it tries to make the credit and the deduction and what they each cover more similar than what they are right now. Members, I think that this bill provides important financial help for public and private school families. The deduction and credit right now covers things like books, school supplies, musical instruments, after-school tutoring, things that children need, and particularly in terms of some of the reference that was made earlier, the credit in particular I think is useful for lower-income families and providing more opportunity, and with this bill would go further toward helping to close the achievement gap. And Madam Chair, I do have a couple testifiers, if you'd be willing to entertain them.
Thank you, Representative Knobloch. And we would call forward Mitch Perlstein and Jim Bartholomew. You'll be on deck. In fact, you could come and join him because there are two chairs sitting there.
Yep.
So thank you very much. Welcome, Mr. Perlstein, to our committee.
Thank you, ma'am.
Please say your name for the record and who you represent and begin your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Knobloch, my name is Mitch Perlstein, and for the past 25 years, I've been fortunate to be president of Center of the American Experiment. I'm also the former chair of several school choice organizations over much of this period, including Minnesotans for School Choice and later the Partnership for Choice in Education. It was Minnesotans for School Choice, which worked closely with Governor Arne Carlson in his successful 1997 campaign for educational tax credits. As satisfying as that victory was, it was dampened by our failure to have tuition included as an eligible expense. I share Representative Knobloch's enthusiasm for correcting this omission this session. I learned 36 years ago, while doing field research for my dissertation at the University of Minnesota, that while well-educated men and women knew that differences in academic achievement between white and most non-white high school students were large on average, they were consistently taken back once they learned how large they were in fact. Such gaps in reading and math across the country have decreased in the last third of a century, but not by terribly much. As for Minnesota, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, NAEP, reported the following more than sobering data for eighth grade students in the state who were either proficient or at advanced levels in math in 2013. White students, 71%. Asian students, 58%. Hispanic students, 26%. Black students, 17%. Results for reading were not a great deal better. It's essential never to lose sight of data like these the next time someone suggests we can eliminate, not just reduce, achievement gaps. If only we really cared, if only we really got serious, if only we greatly expanded early childhood education, which I agree we should, if only we cut class sizes, if only we adopted some special curriculum, if only we held teachers more accountable, if only we spent more money, or if we did this or that. This very sad fact is both reinforced and fueled by enormous differences in the way in which different groups of children come into this world and the homes in which they are raised. Just two national numbers. About 30% of white babies across the country are born outside of marriage. The ratio is over 70% for black boys and girls. The parallel proportions for Hennepin County, the last time I saw the data, was 18% for white babies and 84% for black babies. So why might tax credits do a better job than other educational strategies in helping students overcome such obstacles? A first and honest answer is that they won't in all instances. This is the case for no other reason than no one educational approach is best suited for all young people. Many kids will thrive, say, in a Catholic school or in a Lutheran school or in a private non-religious school, while many others won't. This is all granted. But what have top-tier scholars conducting gold-standard research learned about the connections, in this instance, between vouchers and the educational, social, and life fortunes of thousands of low-income and minority children in other cities and other states? Just two clusters of findings. 12 empirical studies have examined academic outcomes for voucher participants using random assignment, the gold standard of social science. Of these 12, 11 find that vouchers improve student outcomes, 6 in which all students benefit and 5 in which some benefit, and some are not affected. One study finds no visible impact. No empirical study has found a negative impact. 23 empirical studies entailing all research methods have examined vouchers' impact in academic outcomes in public schools. Of these, 22 find they improve public schools, and one finds no visible impact. No empirical study has found that vouchers harm public schools. In arguing for tax credits, most advocates usually go light in framing the issue in moral terms. This is the case since focusing on morality is often viewed as moralizing, which usually doesn't work well, rhetorically or otherwise, in politically, ideologically, and certainly religiously mixed settings. But with the understanding that I do not question the decency of anyone who truly does not believe tax credits are an intrinsically bad deal, who does believe tax credits are an intrinsically bad deal for children, including very poor ones. I've always thought of educational freedom more as an ethical necessity than merely a pedagogical, economic, or political priority. Of a piece with this, aided by the fact that I'm a religious minority, I have been freer and quicker than most other tax credit advocates to talk about why private and religious schools work better for many, certainly not all, low-income and minority boys and girls than do public and secular schools. Freer and quicker, being blunt about it, because I'm less likely to be seen as a member of the religious right. I'm not certain, but I think that might have been a laugh line. In addition to educational issues, most of my research and writing over the decades have focused on families, more specifically on how the United States, for whatever reason, leads virtually the entire industrial world in family fragmentation. This, suffice it to say, is painfully and damagingly hard on many millions of children. Question. What's one of the first words that come to mind about the kind of education which might work best for many of these young people? For me, it's nurturing. More than most kids, those in often jumbled homes need the kind of education that fills not only their need to know algebra and colonial history, but also the kind that nurtures and helps fill holes in their hearts where often their fathers or sometimes where their mothers should be. The kind of education getting right down to it, regardless of denomination, where it's more explicitly understood that someone infinitely more senior than any teacher, principal, or superintendent loves them infinitely and wants them to do great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Perlstein. Mr. Bartholomew, will you introduce yourself and begin your testimony?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and we're here in support of Representative Knobloch's bill as well. We appreciate the fact that it both updates eligibility for families to participate as well as the amount of the expense that's eligible for the credit. We think these are both helpful for families, as Representative Knobloch mentioned, for both public and non-public school families, in the sense that tutoring, music lessons, and technology are eligible expenses and are needs for all. In regard to expansion of the credit to include tuition, we're supportive of that as well. We're both familiar with the research that Mr. Perlstein had mentioned. The gold standard random sample clearly shows that there are benefits to creating options for families for their children. And I guess I'd leave it at that. We think this is a great bill and encourage your support. Thank you.
Representative Knobloch, how many families, more families, would benefit from the deduction?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't have a revenue estimate from the department yet on this, and so I don't have those numbers. I know that this last year there was about 54,000 individuals that benefited from, or 54,000 families, I believe it was,
right,
that benefited from the tax credit. And it was a couple hundred thousand that benefited from the tax deduction. But I guess what additional impact the tax credit would have with these changes, I don't know yet because I don't yet have the revenue estimate.
Thank you. Representative Yarusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When we get some of those estimates, is there any way, to your knowledge, that that could be broken down so we can find out how many families that qualify for free or reduced lunch are able to take advantage of any of these?
Representative Knobloch.
Madam Chair, Representative Yarusso, I think that that may be available. I guess we'd have to look at the revenue estimate at what it gives us and what the free and reduced lunch qualifiers are. We can see what the revenue department gives us, and if you're interested in that, we can certainly get you that information.
Thank you. Are there, yes, Representative Yarusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A fairly middling private high school tuition in the Ramsey County area is about $9,000 a year, which still leaves a substantial gap. How do families that don't owe any tax qualify for this? Do they benefit from this move?
Representative Knobloch,
Madam Chair, I know
this is a question for the Tax Committee, but go ahead.
No, that's fine. Madam Chair, Representative Urusso, this is a refundable tax credit. So if a person has no income tax liability, they would still get potentially the $1,500 per child back. And I guess I'd also mention to your other question about the cost of private school. I know in the St. Cloud area where I'm from, I served on the board of a private school up there for about 5 years, and our tuition there was in the $5,000 to $6,000 range, depending on the grade of the child. Our policy was for low-income students or students from low-income families, we would forgive or give as a benefit half of the tuition back and then expect the family to pay the other half. And we did have families that took advantage of this tax credit, and so if the full tax credit was available for those low-income families, it would go a long ways toward helping them to afford a private school education.
Representative Urusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in that particular case, do you have any estimates of the percent of students who qualified for free and reduced lunch that were in the schools compared to the surrounding area, or percent of students of color compared to the surrounding area?
Madam Chair, Representative Urusso, we had a significant percentage of our school that qualified for our aid. I'd say about half of the families in our school qualified for some sort of tuition reduction from the school. I guess how that compares to the surrounding area, I think it was fairly similar to the surrounding area, not just the St. Cloud School District, but the greater St. Cloud School District. In terms of students of color, we had students of color at the school. We didn't have as many as a proportion that are in the St. Cloud School District. I think partly because of the fact that the St. Cloud District 742 has a large Somali population, and this being a Christian school, we weren't really getting members of the Somali population applying for it.
Representative, are there other questions for Representative Dabney?
Thank you. Mr. Perlstein, I was confused by your comments. I'm not clear how this tax credit or deduction increases marriage rates. You said that was the most important thing, and I'm just having a hard time connecting the dots. Can you connect them for me, please?
Madam Chair, Representative Dobney, the point I was trying to make was not that tax credits would improve marriage rates, but that rather the kids growing up in situations where fathers are often not there, where there is no marriage, that children growing up in those situations would benefit especially, quite often, not always, quite often, by attending a private religious school.
Madam Chair. Representative Dabney.
I don't know the exact numbers, but I can picture the graph, Mr. Perlstein. Governor Carlson's time, since that's the point of reference here, the number of families choosing to send their children to private parochial schools has decreased significantly, both here in Minnesota and nationally. And I don't know the Minnesota numbers, but nationally, private schools tend to underperform public schools when you look at ACT performance rates. Additionally, what I believe to be the largest single provider of private education in the state, the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis, is now bankrupt. Why would we subsidize a activity that the public is choosing increasingly not to participate in, that has, broadly speaking, underperforms the public schools, and where the largest single provider is bankrupt?
Mr.
Madam Chair, Representative Dobney, the studies I'm familiar with, when it comes to enabling low-income students to attend a private school via a voucher or a tax credit. As I mentioned, very good research shows that those kids, on average, do better. Do they all do better in terms of achievement tests? No. Do they do worse than they otherwise would? Generally not. What these programs do though, is lead to many additional minority students, low-income students graduating high school. And if we go back to the research of sociologists like James Coleman and John Brandel, who was a member of the legislature a number of years ago, and I say this as strictly a graduate and an attendee of public schools my entire life. I have never been in a private school as a student my entire life. But for many students, it is clear that a private religious school works better for them. They tend to be safer. Parents like them a lot. And as I say, graduation rates tend to go up.
Madam Chair, if I can just respond to that quickly.
Representative Knobloch.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, I guess, first of all, in terms of fewer people nationally going to private schools, I would tell you that I'm not sure what the cause and effect is there. I think part of it has been that the economy has not been very good the last several years, and a lot of people that would like to send their children to a private school are, because of their economic circumstances, choosing not to do so. I think the problems of the archdiocese here in the immediate metro area don't impact the rest of greater Minnesota, and I'm not sure they're even going to impact the Catholic schools that are here in the metro area. But again, this bill isn't strictly about private school tuition. This is a bill that applies to public school students and public school families, as well as private school students and private school families.
Last question.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Knobloch, if I remember correctly, yesterday's bill introductions included a proposal to include inflation on the state's budget projections for costs. Currently, if I remember correctly, we project increases in revenue on it based on inflation, but not spending. Do you support that bill, and will you be shepherding it through Ways and Means?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, frankly, it's much more complicated than what you just said. For example, if you look at the revenue, if you look at the forecast underneath health care, for example, medical assistance, which is the largest single line item in the entire state budget if you include the federal spending, does have inflation in it. It forecasts both enrollment increases, forecasts increases in how much they think health care is going to cost for the next biennium. If you go to special education, I believe that we have an automatic inflator built into statute right now for special education. And so special education is also forecasted for inflation. So when you, in fact, look at the budget forecast, actually there are some inaccuracies with that, because you are, to some extent, double counting some things where you've already got inflation in medical assistance, you've already got inflation in special education. And when you look at the forecast, while the forecast doesn't formally include inflation, the forecast is based on current law, there always is language about what would be the effect of inflation if you included it. And all the state economist does is just take the inflation rate and add it on to spending, which in this case, for things like medical assistance and special education, is double counting it. And so I guess, Representative Dabney, I do support the idea of the state economist having language in the forecast that gives the legislature an idea of what the effect of inflation would be. But I frankly think the bills that have been introduced on the subject are too simplistic.
Madam Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Impressive for a freshman.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dabney is no ordinary freshman. This is no ordinary freshman, Representative.
No ordinary freshman.
I'm blessed to have been here before and served with many of you, and it's very nice to be back. And I enjoy the exchange too, Representative Dabney. I truly do.
Representative Mariani, it's your turn.
Thank you. And Representative Knobloch and I have served in this body long enough that prior to our gray hairs, we were known to shoot some hoops together on out on the basketball court. That was a lot of fun. Representative Knobloch, I got a number of questions here. So, we haven't mentioned vouchers because that has a particular mechanism to happen for it to be a voucher, but the bottom line here is that by extending the tax credit to cover out tuition, which we did not do during the Arne Carlson years, we drew a line understanding that there would be a direct flow of state appropriations to private institutions. Go ahead, Representative. There would be a de facto straight flow of dollars coming out of our state resources to pay for the expenses of the operations of private schools. Now, there's a lot of debate about some of the research Mr. Perlstein and Mr. Bartholomew, referenced broadly. Lots of other sources of research. It would be great if we spent quite a bit of time looking into all of those sources. We're not going to do that today. However, I will point out that, and I know this is a little bit dated, in October 2007, there was a study of the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program, which I believe is the oldest voucher program in the nation. I actually met the legislator who introduced that bill many, many years ago. And this research was conducted by a collaboration of folks from Stanford University, Michigan State University, Florida State University, and University of Wisconsin. And one of their major conclusions is that, and I'll read this very quickly, a full 8 years after the school district expanded the voucher program, it is still not possible to measure whether voucher students in Milwaukee perform better or worse than their counterparts who remain in public schools. This is a full 8 years after the expansion, so it had already been operating for at least a decade. However, and I don't want to get into a deep research question, but they go on to say the Wisconsin legislature made no provision to evaluate the expanded voucher plan. Representative Knobloch, do you have any language here, or do you have any interest, if this were to move forward, for this legislature to be able to objectively evaluate the effectiveness of the expansion of the tax credit to cover tuition, i.e., in my opinion, a voucher, relative to the broad claims that have been made here this morning that this is the way to close the achievement gap? Would you be interested in that kind of evaluative component in your bill?
Representative Knobloch.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, first of all, this isn't a voucher bill. I was actually a little surprised to hear the discussion of vouchers that came up. Secondly, we have had a private school tax deduction for people in this state since 1955. It's not a new concept. Since it's not a voucher bill, and since we're only, in the best of cases, talking about covering only a small minority of the cost, maybe 25%, let's say, of the cost of private school tuition for someone at even one of the cheapest private schools, I don't really know that this is comparable to any sort of a voucher bill or that it could really even be studied in the same sort of way. But I guess, Representative Mariani, if that sort of a study is something that would gain your support, I'd certainly be willing to talk to you about it.
Well, Madam Chair,
Representative
Knobloch, I'll be up front. This bill does not have my support. In my opinion, if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. And we can call this a tax credit to cover tuition that, over a half a decade ago, we made a decision it would not cover tuition. Or we can be real up front about what we're doing here. However, I do think if we're going to move forward with any of these kind of bills, whether it's this bill or any other, it'd be a smart thing for us. Especially in light of all the assertions that are being made that these are sort of the magic bullets that are going to accomplish this great public good, that we don't just take that at face value, that we build into these kinds of legislation. And this is not a partisan comment. I challenge myself this way. It's how I put my bills forward, that we should evaluate objectively what the impact of this kind of investment is. Let me just ask another question very quickly. One of the differences between our public schools and non-public schools is that there's no legal expectation of our private institutions to equally provide access to all eligible students in the state of Minnesota. I know this for a fact, but Madam Chair, my kids, I'll be up front, my kids have been in all sorts of schools, and they're all grown now. I've had them in public schools, I've had them in private parochial, I've had them in private secular schools and charter schools as well. Ups and downs with all of those. And so when I tell you this, I tell you from experience. In the private schools, one of the super advantages that my kids had when the years that they were there is that they were not part of the general population involved special ed kids. They were not part of a population involved kids who did not speak English dominantly and was not their first language. That's a big challenge to our public schools here. And so it seems to me that if we're going to flow dollars out of our, you know, a tax credit is an expenditure. If we're going to flow dollars out of our general fund to cover our mandate, our requirement to provide equal access to all students, then it seems to me that these private schools, if they're going to be the beneficiaries of tax credits, ought to have that expectation, or actually that mandate, to include special ed kids and ELL kids in their student population. Would you support that kind of movement if we were to be successful with this? That might get my support, Representative Knobloch.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, a couple things. First of all, if I wanted this to be a voucher bill, I would have had the tax credit much higher to be something that matched average private school tuition in the state or something like that. And again, this is only $1,500. It's probably at best 25% of what tuition would be. And again, this is a bill that covers private school students and public school students, and we're kind of focusing a lot on the tuition issue here. In terms of special education, the average private school tuition, I think, unless you're at the very exclusive schools like a Blake or something like that, is in general far below what the average public school tuition is. And I think that's appropriate because the public schools do have additional expenses for things like special education, teaching English as a second language and such that most private school students don't have. I know in the particular private school that I was involved with, we did have some special education students that were there, went out to get services for their special education needs for some part of the day. That is a mandate that we have right now as a state to ensure that all students with special education needs are somehow served, and I certainly support that mandate, but I don't think that we should be putting that mandate on the private schools, because in a large way that takes away the whole idea of choice and letting many different options be out there for people. Again, the amount of money that schools are going to get for something like this is far less than what public schools are getting per student, and I think that that helps compensate for that difference.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Perlstein, actually, I tend to agree with a lot of the comments that you made. The biggest question I have, though, is whether, and this is really for Representative Knobloch, whether a tax credit has, like this, has shown evidence in the past that it's going to change behavior or incent behavior. Is the goal of this to get more people to spend more money on their kids' educational development, or is the goal to put more money into people's pockets? Because tax credits can do either thing. You can either give people more money, and it's essentially a form of wage subsidy, or it is to create a certain set of behaviors. And the question is, do you have any evidence that this tax credit or an expanded version of it is going to get more people to put more time, effort, money, programming, and make it available to their kids in such a way that it would reduce the achievement gap or provide a greater opportunity for more kids?
Representative Knobloch.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler. Well, I think that Mr. Perlstein might be better equipped to talk about some of the academic evidence on this. But again, if you look at the program as it is right now, the credit begins to phase out at a family income of $33,500 a year. So this is a credit that is only available to lower income and very moderately middle-income families. And I think that in many cases, this credit helps those families, and an expanded credit would help more families to be able to afford after-school tutoring, music opportunities, computer software, other learning aids that they simply can't afford right now. And that is my purpose, or one of my purposes, in offering the bill.
Madam Chair, may I add to that?
Yes, Mr. Perlstein.
Thank you very much, Representative Winkler. My aim in all these matters is principally to expand options for parents, mostly, in these instances, lower-income parents. And my apologies if I have moved the conversation in the direction of vouchers as opposed to tax credits. We are here to talk about tax credits. Very much agreed. The point, though, is that the best research on providing lower-income parents greater options, the best research, the most research, has been done via vouchers. So I use that research as a proxy for what expanding tax credits in Minnesota might help lead to. And I'm certainly not of the mind, as I have said, that this is an all-purpose solution to anything. But will it help? I do believe yes.
Madam Chair.
Representative Winkler.
Representative Knobloch, my concern is that you're not, that I'm not sure, and you haven't suggested that you have any evidence to suggest that it would be the case, but my concern is that you are creating a set of policies for a tax credit for things that you think sound like the kinds of things that low-income families need. And a low-income family who is concerned about their children's education might not need tutoring. They just might need stable housing. Or they might need the ability to afford medicine that helps with mental health issues. They may need addiction counseling. They may need a more reliable car to get their kids to where they need to be. They may need a more predictable set of hours for their work. They may need all kinds of things, and by targeting this credit to low-income families based on specific things that you think that they need, it's a form of government micromanaging through tax credit without necessarily presenting evidence that you can encourage people to spend more money on the things that you're actually claiming that this bill does. So the question would be, if we're trying to give more money to low-income people to better maximize their own lives and their ability to provide a stable, supportive family environment for their children, why wouldn't we just increase the earned income tax credit and let them make their own decisions instead of having you make the decisions for them?
Well, Representative Winkler, this is the Education Committee, so I think we want to focus on education. Representative Knobloch.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, I guess I would just say that the law as it exists already provides all these potential options for lower income families. The only additional option that we are adding for lower income families in this legislation is for private school tuition to now be something that they can get a tax credit on, which incidentally is available to all higher income Minnesotans right now through the tax deduction. The tax deduction, which has been in existence since 1955, really doesn't do anything for lower income people, because if you're a lower income people, you're not going to be itemizing your deductions. So right now we are in a sense discriminating against lower income people and only giving the benefit of the tax deduction for private school income, private school tuition to higher income people. So I'm with this bill merely saying that we should extend that same courtesy to lower income people.
But Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, what I'm trying to get to, Representative Knobloch, is whether you have any evidence that this credit actually leads to more kids getting more of what they need to in education. Not whether something has existed for decades or whether it has existed for certain income levels. The question is, do we get a better educational outcome as a result of the tax credit, or are we merely giving money to people who would pursue these kinds of opportunities regardless?
Well, Representative Knobloch.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, as we gave you testimony earlier, there are 54,000 families that are using the credit right now. And I guess it's my personal opinion, and you've heard testimony from Dr. Perlstein, that this sort of a program is something that is beneficial for lower-income people.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, just to
Representative Winkler
kind of complete the point, as an educational matter, there is no evidence that has been cited here today that suggests that expanding this credit or the existence of this credit leads to any better educational outcome for anybody.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, I guess that is your opinion in hearing what Dr. Perlstein has presented. I guess maybe next time I'll have to bring in some families that have personally benefited from the credit and can tell you how it's helped them.
Representative Yarusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mariani made my points.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Knobloch, this is, though a modest, it's like an expansion of public dollars being directed towards private schools. I think we can agree on that with an inflationary factor. So building on Representative Winkler's questions, what accountability measures for these public dollars are you willing to put in place to make sure that children are getting the education that they deserve? The public schools have measures. We have the MCAs. There are just a multiple mandates and measures that public schools have to meet to receive these public dollars. So I'm wondering what accountability measures you would consider putting in place if we were to increase these public dollars flowing to private schools.
Representative Knobloch.
Madam Chair, Representative Seltzer, again, a significant amount of these dollars actually flow to public school students right now. And there actually is quite a bit of accountability already built in through the Department of Revenue. They regularly audit a certain percentage of these returns to make sure that the expenses that are being claimed are, in fact, expenses that were incurred. And so I think there already is accountability that has been built into this for many years.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for talking about the fiscal accountability, but we are in policy, and I'm talking about academic accountability.
Representative Knobloch.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Seltzer, I understand that I believe all the private schools in the state, or at least a very large percentage of them, at least the one I was involved with, take some sort of a standardized test so that you can see how their students are doing as well. And so you do have some accountability to see how the various private schools are performing.
Representative Seltzer.
My last question. Thank you, Madam Chair. But would you be willing to require that? It's required in public schools. I know that a number of private schools do take these tests, but would you be willing to require accountability measures as public dollars, increasing amount of public dollars flow to private schools?
Representative Knobloch.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Seltzer, I guess I am not completely familiar with what existing mandates there are for testing in private schools. I guess I'd have to learn more about that. I'd certainly be willing to take a look at it.
Representative Nornes, state grants, you know, some of which flow to students in private colleges, is there an accountability measure for those dollars from higher ed?
Madam Chair, they would have to qualify to receive it. Beyond that, I don't believe there is any.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, just very quickly following up from Representative Seltzer's line of questioning. Representative Knobloch, you've not been here for a number of years, so you probably missed out on some of the biggest K-12 reform issues or legislation that we did over the past few years. But one, case on point with Representative Seltzer's question, is the creation of the world's best workforce expectation. It is a mandate. And in that mandate, all public schools, obviously receiving, public dollars, are required to show progress against five major goals, including closing achievement gaps. And there's a difference between reporting and accountability, as you well know. You know, so taking the MCA, sets up a reporting mechanism, but for way too long in our state, simply reporting the MCAs really only meant something if you were a Title I school relative to federal funds. The state, a couple of years ago, said, now we want progress against all these goals, and it's going to mean something to the state of Minnesota. And the accountability mechanism here is that the state now, at some point, we're not there yet, so it'll be interesting to see, Representative Seltzer, when we get there, just how courageous our state government is going to be relative to public school systems. But if progress is not made, against those five goals. We're talking about withholding a percentage of their formula appropriations. We've never, ever done anything like that. It's a very bold move on our part, precisely because at the end of the day, we really, truly care about student academic achievement, which goes to Representative Seltzer's question. It seems to me, and it's not really more a question as much as just something for you since you said that you'll ponder it, to really think about. You know, if we were going to go down this track of opening up the pathways for state funds to pay for the tuition of private schools' offerings, then it seems to me that it would be not only fair but actually really smart for us to mirror the world's best workforce expectations on these schools, just as we do with all the other public schools. I'd be glad to spend some time with you to go over, you know, that mechanism, but you know, we either believe in accountability or we don't. And we could certainly point to all sorts of research, which, quite frankly, right now is all over the map. There's nothing conclusive out there that I have seen yet that says that these kind of investments are the wisest investments. Granted, there's nothing out there that's saying this is the worst investment. But the point is, we ought to really do more than just depend on research in other states. We ought to really just hold all schools accountable when they receive public school funds for demonstrating academic achievement, and if they don't, that there'll be consequences for them.
Representative Knobloch.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, just a couple points to that. I guess firstly, as I mentioned before, we have been, in your sense, funneling tax dollars to private schools for private school tuition since 1955 through the education tax deduction, which really only benefits higher income families as opposed to lower income families. I think that without saying no to your request, I think it would be more appropriate if we were going to a voucher program where we were really funding everything as opposed to proposing to fund only a very small percentage of the cost of something like private school tuition. But the other accountability measure that I think we should talk about is the parents. I think there have been all kinds of studies that say that the involvement of a parent is one of the most important factors in whether a student is successful or not. And by providing these sorts of choices, I think we give the option for parents to have more involvement, more choice for their children, that is beneficial for the child. And so while you have the state accountability measures that you're talking about, something like this also promotes and I think helps preserve parental accountability, which I think enhances student education.
Madam Chair, to
Representative Mariani or Representative Dabney.
Thank you. Representative Knobloch, to your last comments, in the last few years, Indiana and Louisiana have established voucher programs. Studies there show that in Indiana, half of the private schools aren't accepting voucher students. In Louisiana, it's three-quarters of the private schools are not accepting voucher students. How do we even know that this expands the sacred cow of parental choice without a requirement that, first of all, any family wishing to use this program be accepted by the private school that they wish to have their student participate in? If we get numbers like Indiana and Louisiana, where the private schools have largely turned their backs on public school students.
Mr. Perlstein, did you have a remark?
Yes, please, Madam Chair, Representative Dobney. A number of years ago, I had some real doubts along the lines that you have just expressed, and if I wanted to use a metaphor, it was the old line about big cat, no cattle. They were schools talking about how they wanted to bring in low-income kids, but if it got to the point where there were tax credits or vouchers so those kids could enroll, I wasn't confident, to be perfectly frank, that those schools in great numbers really wanted to enroll those kids. I have since changed my mind. I have spoken to enough people in various Catholic, Lutheran, Christian education schools. There has been a very good study done showing that there are 25,000 vacant seats in private schools in this state, most of them in the Twin Cities area. And if some schools don't want to participate, that is absolutely their right. But do I believe That most will? The answer is yes.
Representative Lucero.
Madam Chair.
Well, we're not talking about vouchers, Representative Dabney.
Well, Mr. Perlstein and Representative Knobloch are.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, I'm not. No, I didn't. Mr. Perlstein did. I did not. This is a tax credit bill.
Madam Chair, Representative Knobloch, your last set of comments included references to vouchers. That's why I chose to go here. When we look at not our biases or preconceptions or whatever, but actual data from two states that recently established voucher programs, and we see 75% of the private schools don't participate, 50% of the private schools don't participate, that's not about biases or perceptions or assumptions or projections. That's about actual facts about how private schools are not accepting public school students where there is a voucher there for them to get money from the state.
Well, and Representative Dabney, you can ask that question in finance. Representative Lucero.
Madam Chair. I just wanted to make a quick remark as I'm listening to the testimony this morning, and that I'm very pleased to hear some of the remarks that I'm hearing come from the other side. For example, Representative Salter's concern about accountability of outcomes prior to spending money on dollars. Representative Winkler's high concern regarding the government's micromanaging in the lives of citizens. Representative Mariani's concern about research demonstrating the wisdom prior to allocating public dollars to different programs. So just pleased to hear some of these remarks.
Closing remarks, Representative Knobloch. We have two more bills to get to.
All right. Well, Madam Chair, members, I appreciate the discussion. I do want to say, Representative Dabney, we kind of got... weren't able to complete our thought there. If you could check the tape, I didn't say anything about vouchers. I just simply said that I believe this tax credit program would expand choices for parents, and that the accountability that parents provide through that would be good. You can check the tape. I don't think I said anything about vouchers other than saying that this is not a voucher bill. Members, I do think that this would enhance parental choice for public and private school students. It would help lower income families that are having difficulty with some of these school expenses right now, and I'd encourage your support for the bill.
Thank you. Well, Representative Lucero renews his motion that House File 798 be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay.
No.
The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to Education Finance. Thank you, gentlemen, and thank you, Representative Knobloch, for a good debate.
Thank you.
Representative Erdahl. Welcome to the testifying table, Representative Erdahl. You can move your own bill, and I believe you also have an amendment that you're going to want to move.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I move House File 245 and that it be referred to Education and Finance, and also would move the A1 amendment.
Will you please explain your amendment?
The amendment just clarifies what type of master's degrees that elementary school teachers can obtain and get a credit for.
Is there any discussion regarding the H0245A1 amendment? And seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Please explain your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first, I'll just mention also that my other co-author on this is Representative Aaron Murphy, who has a very similar bill. In fact, I think the same bill. For those who have heard me over the years, I've been espousing some things about the Finnish model of education. When I was there a few years ago visiting their schools, I asked a principal in a Finnish school to what did they attribute the international success of their education system. And he said to me three things: teachers, teachers, teachers. And then clarified that by saying that all the teachers came from the top 10% of the graduating class, and all of them had to have a master's degree in their content area, in other words, in what they actually teach. The figures that I have seen here, both statistically and anecdotally, and in talking to the various school groups, when I take my poll, 3 out of 5 teachers who get master's degrees in Minnesota do not get them in their content area. If you're a math teacher, you don't get a master's degree in math, for the most part. You may get it in curriculum design or administration or something like that. What I'm trying to do, and I've struggled with this over the years, in how to do it. I've come up with all kinds of different ideas, some punitive. You don't get as much of a lane change if you don't get a master's in your content area, whatever. And I discarded all of those and decided that the best way to approach this would be through a tax credit. And so, in essence, if you get a tax credit in your content area, if you obtain a master's in your content area, you get a $2,500 tax credit. Master's degree costs approximately $15,000. So this moves them in that direction. Is it enough? Remains to be seen, I guess. I hope that this is enough to incentivize people to go the direction that we wish them to go. Does it absolutely guarantee you become a better teacher? No. There are a lot of great teachers out there who don't have master's degrees in their content area. However, in a general sense, I firmly believe, and there are statistics that back this up, that if you know more about what you're teaching, you should be a better teacher. And in its essence, that's what I'm trying to do with this. This is the first of a series of bills that you'll be hearing from me that have as their goal maintaining a high-quality teacher in the state of Minnesota. And so with that, I'll just also mention this. There have been requests that I include nationally board-certified teachers and maybe some of the categories. I'm trying to keep this focused to just this area for this session. Maybe in terms of money availability or whatever in the future, this can be expanded, but I think this is the way we should go right now.
And you have a testifier, I believe, who has a time schedule.
Yes.
So, Mr. Jolly, would you join us, please, at the testifying table? And introduce yourself. Welcome to our committee. And explain your support of this provision.
Happy to do so. I'm Dr. Eric Jolly, president of the Science Museum of Minnesota. Madam Chair, members, I am delighted to have an opportunity to speak to this bill. A bit about my background in education. I've worked in a number of universities and research institutions, been assistant chancellor, as well as a dean of arts and sciences and a dean of education. I am currently the chair of the National Academies of Sciences expert panel on STEM learning, and I am on the National Academy of Engineering panel on engineering education for K-12. I have served for more than 6 years on the Mathematical Sciences Education Board of the National Research Council and been a scientist in funding for research on evaluation and learning at the National Science Foundation for more than 25 years. My remarks are predicated in part on all of the research resources that I have through the National Academies, as well as the Harvard Project on the Next Generation of Teachers, the Stanford Center for Opportunity and Policy Education 2010 report, the National Commission of Teaching and America's Future, and the Alliance for Excellence in Education on the Path to Equity, Improving Teacher Effectiveness as major research studies. I'll be glad to speak to any of those. I'm here because...
And I was a social studies teacher.
And I am here because the Science Museum has in its mission, perhaps the only museum in the world to have in its mission, to improve policy. We believe that policy needs to be based on research, that we need to trust the data, and that we will at the Science Museum support that which creates a thriving scientific community and enterprise through education, opportunity, and use of science. And so I'm here to speak to the effectiveness of this bill for master's degree in disciplinary content. There is never unmitigated research conclusions in the field of education. But the best that we can see, I am delighted with the idea of improving the percentage of teachers with master's degrees in disciplinary fields in Minnesota. This is an exceptionally important goal for us. Number one, teachers with master's degrees in disciplinary content, when held constant for time and profession, have higher student outcomes for all students. Number two, teachers with disciplinary content right now are less available to our minority and low-income students in this state as they are in the nation. Number three, teacher retention is a growing problem in the United States, although in the last 2 years there has been modest improvement in our retention rates. 4 years ago, we crossed the threshold where time to degree now exceeds time in profession. And all research shows that the longer teachers in the profession, the better the quality of outcome for students. I am not here about who chooses what. I'm here about what students learn. Teacher retention, by most reports, is increased when teachers have disciplinary degree earnings by a factor of nearly twofold, from under 5.25 years in profession to over 10 years in profession. And so I support this bill because teachers with degrees in their field will increase student outcomes, increase teacher retention, and move to professionally advancing the profession of teaching, which is a level of respect that the state needs to give all of those who care for the next generation of our youth. That is my purpose in supporting this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Jolly. Representative Dabney, do you have a quick question?
I do, and I'm not sure whether it's for Representative Erdahl or actually Representative Nornes. Representative Erdahl, while I think you can overmake the argument about degrees in the field, the PhD engineer who's spent a career in engineering doesn't necessarily know how to teach kids. They may have a greater depth in the field, but not know how to translate that and build relationships with kids. I think your proposal hits the sweet spot because you're working with people who presumably have demonstrated an ability to work with kids and now want to deepen their content knowledge. The challenge I've always understood, however, and this is where I rope in Representative Nornes, is that the higher education institutions traditionally have made it very difficult for someone to teach and get a master's in the field. That their programs for an MED, such as I have and you may well have, are structured around a teacher's schedule. The biology teacher who wishes to get a master's in biology often would have to take a year off from teaching in order to do that. How do we move higher education into a position of being more responsive to what Dr. Jolly has pointed out, the research shows will strengthen our K-12 system? And I'll throw that softball out to the both of you and see which one of you catches it.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dabney and Representative Nornes certainly is welcome to join in as well. But first of all, it does happen. I mean, teachers do get master's degrees in their content area. Under our current system, it is possible. Now, certainly if there are ways to encourage or be more flexible with higher education to do what you're suggesting, I would certainly look at ways to do that. But it is possible to do it the way it's being done now.
Representative Nornes, very quickly, we're going to lay this bill
Madam
over.
Chair, I don't know if there's much I can add to that, but it's a good discussion to have maybe at a later time. Sabbaticals, I think, are often the choice that the teacher makes if the school allows, so that they do leave teaching for a year to get that degree, and that's a sacrifice for them if they go that route. But so I think we need to talk about it further when we have more time.
And Representative Erdahl, we're going to lay your bill over maybe till the end of the meeting or later, because we have many visitors here on the next bill. So okay. Thank you. And thank you very much, Mr. Jolly, for joining us. Representative Mariani.
I know you're pressed, but I just a quick indulgence. I just wanted to welcome Dr. Jolly here to the legislature. Science Museum is in my district. Dr. Jolly is a remarkable just person and educator. And, you know, the Science Museum, quite frankly, is one of the gems in our state. If you look across the nation, it's a giant among providers to other museums. And not only that, but a provider in a way that enhances the quality of life, including the educational outcomes of students, not only here in Minnesota, but across the nation. We're really, truly blessed to have both this institution and this remarkable leader in our presence. So thank you for being here this morning.
Yes, and thank you. Thank you very much,
thank you so much.
Mr. Jolly. It's
thank you.
Been great to have you. Representative Runbeck, House File 359. Welcome to the committee, Representative Runbeck. Representative Christensen, would you move House File 359? Representative Christensen, would you move House File 359?
Madam Chair, so moved.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Christensen moves House File 359 to be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. Welcome, Representative Runbeck, and please proceed to introduce yourself and explain your bill, and then we'll hear from your testifiers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for the opportunity to bring House File 359. And what we're doing here, I'm back with the Decoding Dyslexia Group. They are a Minnesota chapter of a national group of parents that work on the issue of dyslexia. There is a national movement that's growing, which is very exciting. But we're here to modify a bill from last year, the tax credit bill. We're building on this, on the education tax credit that was allowed for parents to have access to specialized instruction on reading. And we're modifying the bill to make it a little bit easier for parents to access and to use by changing the gatekeeper provision. Last year's gatekeeper essentially said that children had to get an IEP assessment and be deemed ineligible for that, and that had some unintended consequences. The bill this year would say that a licensed psychologist can provide the test, the diagnosis, and that tax credit could be used also for the evaluation itself. So I have with me Rachel Berger, and she's the chairwoman, volunteer chair of this group, and doing a great job, and she'll kind of explain a little bit more in detail. And I have Jody Smith is going, can provide some personal experience with the struggle with dyslexia. So I don't know who wants to go first.
Welcome to our committee, both of you, and members. Tomorrow is Voices of Dyslexia Day. And in room 300 North, they will receive those of us who would like to visit between 1 and 3.
Madam
and they will
Chair
have
Fonda?
Special speakers. Yes.
That is next Wednesday. The
oh, 25th. That's next Wednesday. Okay. Thank you. That's even better.
Would like
February 25th.
Be
thank you, Ms.
Next
Berger.
Wednesday rather yes. than next than tomorrow.
Well, we can stop tomorrow, too, and get reinforced. Thank you very much. Yes, February 25th. Please introduce yourself, Ms. Berger, and begin.
Well, I'm Rachel Berger, and I've been working with Decoding Dyslexia for the last 2 years, probably almost 2 years to the date. A group of us parents and teachers got together and decided to start advocating for some of the things that we believe in for our children with dyslexia in the state of Minnesota. The group of us is concerned with the limited access to interventions for our dyslexic children within our public schools. Again, as I said, we're made up of a group of not only parents who are impacted by this, whether we have dyslexia ourselves or our children do, but we're also made up of educators and business professionals who also agree on this issue. So a couple of the things that we're working on just briefly, because I know that time is of the issue today, we are working to, we have a long-term and a short-term goals, and we're working to, one, have dyslexia as a definition in the state of Minnesota. too. We'd like to have early identification and early appropriate remediation for these students.
And Ms. Berger, we're going to hear that bill very shortly in the future. So
yes,
thank you for outlining it.
So those are some of the things. And the tax credit that we have here that you're hearing today is something that we came up with that is a short-term fix right now until we can start beginning our work in earnest with the education and on the other side. So, again, we passed the tax credit last year. Unfortunately, it was not accessible to the parties it was intended for. And so this year we've come back around and looked at how we can open that up and make that accessible to the population it was intended for and to give the parents the ability to serve those children. So I'd like to introduce to you Jody Smith, who is able to speak about her personal experience a little bit more, outline that for you, what it was like for her.
Welcome, Ms. Smith, and I've heard your testimony before, so there were some of us who worked on a group for a couple of years under Representative Runbeck's leadership and Senator Chamberlain, who's in the audience. So, Ms. Smith, thank you very much,
thank
and tell
you.
Your
morning.
Story to us.
Good morning, Madam Chair. As far back as I can remember, school was a constant source of pain for me.
Would you introduce yourself, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. I am Jody Smith. Thank you. School was a constant source of pain for me. Even in first grade, as a six-year-old child, I can remember feeling like I was dumb. I can remember working on a color-by-number worksheet, and I didn't understand the concept of matching the number on the page to a specific color, so I just randomly colored the whole page. When I handed in the worksheet, my teacher looked at the paper and then back at me, and what felt like forever, she finally said, in the most demeaning way possible, "What were you thinking?" And I had to lie. My teacher made me feel embarrassed and ashamed, and unfortunately, this became a theme for me. By fourth grade, my confidence in academics was completely gone. School was a nightmare, and I was no longer thinking about trying to finish assignments. Instead, I was thinking about the best way to hide. I didn't want anyone to find out that I was stupid. I never talked in class, and not to my peers. I wanted to be invisible. In high school, things got worse. As far as grades were concerned, D's were just fine, and C's were something I celebrated. I was routinely assigned detention. This was a safe place for me. I didn't have to worry about reading aloud or not understanding yet another assignment. I had lowered my own academic standards to the lowest possible point, and I cried every day. I hated me, and I hated my life. I wanted to be someplace, any place other than where I was. Junior year was the hardest year academically. I had three different teachers ask me to withdraw from their classes. I consulted with my high school guidance counselor, and she informed me that I didn't really need the classes I was failing unless I planned on going to college. And it was at that point that it hit me. They never believed I could go to college, and that decision wasn't mine to make. It had been decided for me, and I wasn't college material. Having very few options for post-secondary school, I took a minimum wage job at a bank, and I began working full-time. I thought that having a job would be less stressful than being in school, and I wouldn't have to look or feel dumb. However, that was not the case. What had been haunting me throughout my school years was still a part of my life. Finally, after a few years of questioning whether I had a learning disability, I met someone who encouraged me to get tested. I went through the process, and the doctor confirmed that I am dyslexic. While this news was a relief, I was now faced with a new challenge, the burden of having to finance my tutoring to learn how to read at the age of 25. My 12 years in the public education system never acknowledged or addressed my struggle to read, write, and spell. So now, there I was 5 years later, having to pay because my free and appropriate education did not provide this for me. This is why I'm here to help support this tax credit. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Smith. Representative Runbeck, do you have other testifiers?
Madam Chair, I think if there are questions, we probably have some folks who can answer any technical questions that might come up.
So we'll move to questions.
Perhaps apparently we have a teacher who can add a few insights of her own.
Please, please come forward and tell your story as well. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Introduce yourself, please, for the record.
Good morning. My name is Jane Conlin. I'm a special education teacher. I have over 30 years of experience working in both public, private schools, and in the charter schools. I am also dyslexic, and I have a dyslexic daughter. Recently, I opened a tutoring center in St. Paul, to try and help some of the families that I've been hearing stories from and working with in the schools every day. These families are struggling. I watch their frustrations as they have exhausted the resources and the options that they have available to them through the school districts, and their child continues to fall behind. These families are forced to find outside help in the school system. It creates incredible financial and emotional strain as they struggle in their efforts to educate that child. They are burdened not only with budgeting time, 4 to 8 hours a week for tutoring, but financially securing thousands of dollars a year to pay for that tutoring. Some families have the financial means to do this. Many parents can't afford the outside support for their child, and they fall through the cracks. Our parents are being asked to pay taxes to support the public schools. I work in the schools. I know that we are not meeting the needs of the dyslexic kids. These families are being stretched emotionally. They're being stretched financially. They are committed, responsible people who are struggling to do the best they can for their children. I really believe we need to support the efforts and the sacrifices they're making, and this bill is going to provide the financial help to families who currently can't afford to pay for the tutoring, as well as for families who are already paying twice for their child's education.
Ms. Conlin, have you had special training then in teaching dyslexic children?
I have. I spent 3 summers going to California working with a dyslexic expert who has written a curriculum that supports research-based methods on teaching dyslexic people. I'm a certified tutor.
And Ms. Conlin, do you know to what extent are other teachers in special needs are learning these strategies to use?
I do. There are very few people who are able to do this and understand dyslexia. As a matter of fact, in the public school system I was at, they asked to have me speak to the special ed staff and to work with the teachers, and they requested that I do a workshop and was told no, thank you, because it would be too confusing for everybody.
And thank you very much for your testimony. And Ms. Berger, we have a growing number of children who are being identified as dyslexic, correct?
Yes, we do. The current statistics support that 1 in 5 children, or about approximately 25% of our students, which if you look at our Minnesota population, that's around 135,000 Minnesota public students. Or I guess they don't necessarily have to be public, but no. 135,000 students.
Thank you. Representative Urusa, you have a question. Okay. Representative Renbeck, others that you would like? Oh, Representative Nornes, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Madam Chair, I just wanted to add to our conversation. I think what we've just heard is that this is a growing concern in our public education system, and I think too little attention has been paid to it over time. This bill does probably not enough to go in that direction, but it's certainly helpful. And I remember when I was on the school board back in the 80s, we had a family that came to us, and that's the first that I'd ever heard of the word dyslexia. And we were chastised for not doing enough for that particular family. And I won't go into a lot of detail because some of them are still in our community in leadership positions, and I'd be embarrassing them if I pointed them out. But so I guess my point is that it doesn't have anything to do with intelligence, and they can be very successful, but they do need special help. And so I just wanted to point that out. I also found out just this year, I have a sophomore grandson. So he's a sophomore in high school, pardon my voice, who has just been diagnosed, who actually was in his 9th year. So this is the first full year that he's being attending high school with the knowledge that he needs the special help. But it took 9 years before that to really be diagnosed. So, and that really is a tragedy. A tragedy. So, I point that out for what it's worth. Often they're lumped in with special needs, and that's probably inappropriate in a lot of cases. So, I'm just here to support the bill.
So, Madam Chair, I think those are good points, and I think that's why we're saying this is a first step, but it will at least draw attention and get parents more opportunity and options.
Representative Seltzer, do you have a question?
No.
Okay, very good.
Oh, Representative Ward, sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure, perhaps Representative Runbeck would be the best one. I'm just a little confused about the effective date on the bill, the end we have. Why is this retroactive? Why are you setting it up so it's retroactive? And then why was do you know the history of why it was only originally for 2014?
Representative Runbeck, first of all, maybe you need to address the retroactivity as the legislator.
Madam Chair, I'm going to pass that off to Ms. Berger.
Ms. Berger.
I think I can answer that. The retroactivity has to do with the fact that last year when we passed the bill, unfortunately with what happened as it was rolled into the omnibus, it was not accessible to the population. So the stipulation this year is that it's retroactive, so giving those people that it was intended for last year as well the ability to use that which was passed and intended for them.
Thank you. Closing comments, Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Committee. I think this has been a great effort, and I love the fact that it's really being pushed at the grassroots by parents who are very informed, very knowledgeable, and very concerned about their children, and haven't attempted to interact with our school systems at various levels. So I think we're making a great effort here to give them some tools.
Thank you, Representative Runbeck. And I think, Representative Russo, you do have a question now?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. It's really a response to the answer we got to Representative Ward's question. It sounded to me almost like what you meant in the answer was that it was an inadvertent omission. And we had quite a bit of discussion about this, both in the working group and in individual conversations and as we crafted the bill. So I don't think it was an inadvertent omission. I think it was because it wasn't quite ready to go forward in the form that you would have liked. And so I really question this retroactivity because it seems like it's a way to reverse the intent of the previous year, you know, and the previous year's legislation was a compromise to get, you know, advanced down the road a little bit, and now we're working on it further. So if we wanted to start making policies retroactive like this, we'd have a whole set of statutes to be doing that too. So I don't think it's appropriate in this case.
Well, Representative Runbeck, you will be answering that question in finance, no doubt.
Madam
so
Chair, exactly.
We'll look forward to that. With that, Representative Christensen renews his motion that House File 359 be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and this bill is on its way. Mr. Amoroso, did you want to make a comment about these tax credit bills before we adjourn? Thank you very much, and to the families who came, I'm sure we had among them children who have need, and I thank you so much for coming, and hope that you will come back when we hear Representative Runbeck's bill, to which Ms. Berger referred. That will be soon. Thank you very much. Mr. Amoroso, please introduce yourself for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gary Amoroso, Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. I appreciate you giving me a minute before the committee has to be done for the day. Just wanted to share that from our association's perspective, we have a lot of questions and it leads into some concerns when we start talking about using the public dollars away from the public schools. And we're not saying that the concepts aren't ones that are worth exploring, but when we're in an environment where we believe the public schools have not received the adequate funding over the last, you know, decade plus, it's troublesome to think that we're talking about taking public dollars and moving them into non-public situations. We were pleased that there was conversation today about tying some of the bills to the rate of inflation. That's something that we strongly would support for the general ed formula. Representative Mariani mentioned that this morning, and we would love to work with all of you on that as we move forward. But with that, Madam Chair, thank you for allowing us to share those thoughts.
Thank you, Mr. Amoroso. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.